Welcome to the midday for Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and we have more live music in our Buck studio for today. It's a final forte finalist. Liam Mayo has come to us from Green Bay, where he's finishing out his junior year of homeschooling and has a lot of other things going on, too. And welcome to the midday.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so what was that when we were doing sound checks? Was that the Aeneid, or was that the...
The opening lines of the Iliad.
Iliad. I knew it was something to do with Aeneas, of course. You know, Wrath of Achilles. And is that something you learn routinely?
I just happened to memorize that a few years back for fun and kept it up because it's some awesome poetry.
Well, give us some of that. What the heck?
Rage. Goddess, sing the rage of Peleus' son, Achilles. Murderous. Doomed. Which cost the Achaeans countless losses, hurling down to the house of death many souls, great fighters' souls, but left their bodies carrion, feasts for the dogs and birds, and the will of Zeus was moving towards its end.
Is that your theatrical debut that we just heard, or are you obviously done this before?
I've been in a lot of theater productions, so it comes naturally to me.
What kind of roles have you played?
For instance, I've been Dill in a play of To Kill a Mockingbird, and Winthrop in the Music Man musical.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's so you are, and you were also into role playing.
Yes, I do that for fun with my brother and some friends.
Okay, before we get into some music, how does that work?
Basically, we create a world together, and a fictional world. And then we choose characters within that, usually not very defined characters. We just have a few basic informations about them. And then we just go on adventures together as those characters and learn more about the characters on the way, make up things about the characters on the way. And by the end, we've developed into a really full-fledged, rich world. So it's very nice.
Okay. Well, that's making you multidimensional already here. Now, your teacher, Anthony Padilla, was here a few months ago playing during the midday. And how long have you been working with him?
7 or 8 years. I don't know exactly.
From your standpoint, time immemorial.
Yes.
And I think that he probably played some Bach when he was here, too, if I remember right. But you're going to start with something from the Partita number 6 in E minor, and a toccata is a show of skill.
Yes. For finger dexterity and lightness of touch, sometimes with fugal interludes like this one has, and usually very improvisatory like this one is.
Very improvisatory. Bach gives you room to improvise?
No. It's meant to sound like it's improvisatory.
And that is so true of Bach. I mean, if you listen to the Brandenburg Concertos, you know, great performance of those, they seem like little jam sessions, don't they? It's fascinating how he does that.
Yeah. And he was one of the greatest improvisers of his time, so it makes sense that his music would have the same quality.
Well, all right, here we go then. The toccata from the Partita No. 6 in E minor by Bach is played in our Buck studio today by Liam Mayo.
Thank you.
Toccata from the Partita number 6 in E minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, played in our Buck studio this afternoon during the midday by Liam Mayo, one of the final Forte finalists for 2016. And, of course, that had a lot of counterpoint in it. Mm-hmm. Is there any particular technical challenge to playing counterpoint?
You need to make sure that all the voices come out, not just the melody line. That's the easy bit. But you need to make sure every voice has something to say and that it's always saying it. It's far too easy for the secondary voices to become basically one secondary glob. But they need to all have their own unique voice, and they need to all have their own unique statement throughout all times.
Can you show us just a little bit of that? Can you revisit that piece or another one for that matter? Whatever
sure.
You have there handy, just to demo some counterpoint.
So like for the first theme, when it comes in, it starts with one voice, then two voices, then three voices, but each time it needs to, every voice needs to keep being its own melody throughout, so. So here that voice transitions from melody to secondary, but still needs to maintain its power. And here the voices are joined by a third melody, but they still need to maintain their own power. And the challenge is making them all unique when so much is going on.
And you've got how many hands?
Two.
Yeah, and it sounds like sometimes more than that.
Yes.
With all those voices singing.
It would be nice to have more than two.
Well, I'm sure there are occasions where Bach would sound very good that way. That brings us to Beethoven, and of course, very different kind of challenges with Beethoven. And
yes.
What you're going to be playing a fast movement, which is to say a presto from one of the early-ish Beethoven sonatas. Mm-hmm. What's the characteristic of this that we would be hearing in your performance?
It's very light, vivid. I've always thought of it as Beethoven sort of showing off.
No, impossible.
Well, by this time in his life, he's already established himself as a composer. So, and Beethoven was always a little egotistical. So this piece is very flashy, very showy, or this movement. And it's kind of like him showing off.
So this is the Sonata in D, Opus 10, number 3. It actually starts with a presto?
Yes, and that's unusual for Beethoven sonatas. They're mainly allegros.
Sure. Thank you. Beethoven, that was the Presto, the first movement from the Sonata in D, Opus 10, number 3, played in our Buck studio today by Liam Mayo. Now, a lot of times when you were playing that, Liam, you were left hand crossed over your right to go into the treble. I've seen that a fair amount with music by Beethoven and his contemporaries, Diabelli, for example. Is that pretty much a thing of that time, or do you do that a lot in music of other periods?
I've seen it mostly in that time. It may show up in other periods, but not so much.
Well, I was going to say, show us what that sounds like for a second that we can hear your left going over your right into the treble there.
Well, it creates the effect of the same melody line continuing in the bass and the soprano, which would usually be two separate ones, or at least complementary, while something else is going on with the right hand, such as here. So it jumps back and forth and sounds like one line, even though it's in those two very separate registers.
And then sometimes it's more than just a little quick hit and run. It's a whole another voice coming up left hand into the treble like that. And actually, now that I look at what you have brought in, Liam, it's chronological.
Yeah.
And so that's going to give us a good sort of survey of keyboard technique over the course of several generations, the exception being we'll wrap it up with some Chopin in a few minutes. So we have actually Chopin represented twice, and in the first instance, and we were talking about this the other day on the air, this whole business of John Field versus Frederic Chopin, and I was talking with John O'Connor last Friday about this, and the difference between the two, but there's no question that Chopin took the Nocturne to heights previously unknown and really makes them not just song-like, but what else is going on, do you think, in the Nocturnes of Chopin that makes them such standouts? Hard to say.
Yeah, it's hard
to say.
Can
be hard to say. I mean, it's the same thing as like what makes one melody much more famous than another by the same composer. I mean, two consecutive pieces, and one of them, you know, like the Dvorak Humoresques, for example, number 7. Everybody knows that one, but there are 8, and the first 6, and the last one, who can whistle those?
Yeah.
It's just one of those musical mysteries. But you picked which one from the Chopin?
The C-sharp minor, Opus 27, number 1.
Is there anything in particular that stands out for you in this one?
Well, what stands out for me in this one is how it transitions from the quiet nocturne into a more passionate middle section. That contrast, which is very Chopin-esque, is sort of what sets this one apart to me from other nocturnes, which just remain very quiet and calm. It's sort of like the quiet of the night broken by this fire and this passion and this anguish, which is really quite beautiful.
Yes, and I've heard sometimes even biographical, you know, interpretations put on this was Chopin waiting for George Sand to come back and, you know, having doubts and questions and all this about the relationship and then perhaps resulting in tranquility. But of course, you can put your own program to it, can't you?
Yeah.
So Nocturne in C-sharp minor, Opus 27, number 1 by Chopin. Thank you. Nocturne in C-sharp minor, Opus 27, number 1 by Chopin, played by Liam Mayo. And we'll get back to Liam Mayo and also have our quiz question, our belated 12:30 quiz question, right after this here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And now, back to Liam Mayo here in our Buck studio with a short piece. It's an etude. There are at least a couple of sets of these by Alexander Scriabin. There's the Opus 8s from about 1894 or so, and then this from the latter set, which is Opus 42.
Yes.
Composer whose style is a little hard to characterize. He came at such a pivotal time.
Yeah. He was one of the more modern composers. He was very influenced by color in his music. Some people have speculated that he was actually able to see music as colors.
We hear people who do that. Yeah, that's synesthesia.
Synesthesia, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he even actually pioneered the use of light during a performance, I think, light shows.
Yes, he'd had several shows like that where he tried to bring together all the different senses, light, scents with incense, and several of them were so large scale that they weren't produced until many years after his death with modern technology.
Well, on the other extreme, we have this slender etude in F sharp major by Scriabin.
Yes, it's only 1 minute long or so, a very short, very sweet, very much a mood piece to convey a certain impression. Some people think it's more like a mosquito. I find it not quite that annoying. I think it's more of a hummingbird darting about and stuff.
That's a little bit more poetic.
Yes.
So here we go. This etude in C-sharp, or etude in F-sharp by Scriabin. Let's say a hummingbird.
Yes.
Does sound better. Now, before you got too busy with school, Liam, you did some ballet, right?
Yes, I did.
And how does that relate to your work as a pianist, especially when you're playing music that comes from a ballet?
Well, especially for music that comes from ballet, such as the next set of pieces from Romeo and Juliet ballet, I'm able to visualize how this music would be danced to, and it gives me insight into a different aspect of it. It gives me sort of another way to look at the piece. For instance, in the next piece I'm going to play, Mercutio Masks, I was having a lot of trouble with the opening, getting it light enough. Then I related that to a certain ballet step that I realized would go very well there, and was able to get it light by imitating that step.
I would imagine there'd not be a lot of pianists who would have that kind of insight.
Yeah, I try to keep well-rounded like that because I think it's cool and because it allows me to see things in a different way like that.
All right. Do you want to couple that with Mercutio or do one at a time?
No, couple.
Okay.
They go well together because Masks is Romeo, Benvolio, and Mercutio beginning their gate crash of the Capulet's party, putting on the masks and preparing to enter, whereas Mercutio is when they have successfully gatecrashed the party, and Mercutio is cavorting about. So they're a nice pair.
All right. Well, thanks for putting that into contemporary terms for us. These are from 10 pieces for piano, Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev, Masks and Mercutio. Thank you. Great stuff, Prokofiev. That was Masks and Mercutio from Romeo and Juliet. Now, Yameo has one more. And by the way, you're not hearing any pages turn because there are no pages. This is all from memory. And I know it has some advantages, but it's also pretty impressive. That's a lot of notes. So the Scherzo number 1 in B minor by Chopin.
Yes, this Scherzo was written early in Chopin's career, just after he had left Poland for good and the Polish uprising had been crushed. So this piece is very much a tribute to that, with the outer sections being very passionate, turbulent, anguished almost. And then the middle section is actually a Polish Christmas carol.
Oh, is it?
So okay. It's sort of his tribute to his homeland.
Be listening for that in the Scherzo number 1 in B minor.
Thank you.
You about have to stand up to get the leverage on some of those more powerful chords, don't you?
Yeah, it helps.
That makes for a very dramatic theatrical effect, too.
Very much so.
Especially for one who's so well-versed in theater and dance and, of course, piano. Let's see. So you said, Liam, you've been studying for what, 12 years?
Yes, quite some time.
So that would be since you were four or
yes.
so? And what's the musical context of your, you know, your family and your surroundings that would have led you to be a pianist at the age of four?
I guess I listened to a lot of the Baby Einstein tapes.
Uh-huh.
And I think my mom put on classical music to help me sleep and stuff. Not entirely sure. But also, when I was really young, I would start picking out the counter melodies in things we were listening to and start humming them.
Oh, really?
And my mom would get really creeped out because she'd never noticed those before. But then I started singing them, and then she'd notice them in the music. So she decided that I should probably go into music.
Other musicians in your family?
My brother is.
Oh, he is? Your yes. fellow role player?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there may be a genetic pairing there between role playing and piano.
I hope so.
And when is your next appearance?
I'm going to be performing at the first Concert on the Square in Madison.
June 29th.
Yes.
What are you going to be playing for that occasion?
The Mendelssohn First Concerto.
Now, is that the one that you played during the Final Forte?
Yes, it is.
And you'll be playing what part of that are?
At least the first and third movements. Still waiting to hear on the second.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that, and thanks for coming in today and sharing your music for the midday.
Thank you for having me.